Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield, made by you.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Dawn? You know what? I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3 here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
Hello, I'm Harry Wilburn. I present Steel & Wire every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Americana, Bluegrass, American Roots, and more. Lots more. Lots of guests, lots of local music and musicians. That's Steel & Wire, Wednesday, 10 a.m.
You're listening to fabulous Harry Wilburn on Steel & Wire.
Before. It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
If you love new music and you want to discover the best new artists out there, then tune into The Backroom with me, Paddy. I'll be playing the best of new indie, electro, EDM and punk and showcasing new Sheffield talent. Also music news, local and national gig guide and new album releases. So tune into The Backroom every Thursday night between 6 and 7 p.m. here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM.
This is Sheffield Live.
N-E-X.
Good morning. Welcome to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire or sheffieldlive.org. You can listen online there. You can also download the podcast later. Listen at your leisure. This show is all about science in all its different forms. You've got Julie and Paul here live in the studio. Later in this hour, we'll be talking to RPG. We've also got a guest speaker this Saturday, and indeed every fourth Saturday of the month, it's Chris Dale, who'll be talking about plane turbulence. We did that a while back last year, but I'm afraid we didn't have a very good phone signal, which was a bit of a shame. All being well, next Saturday, and indeed whenever there are five Saturdays in the month, our guest speaker is Phil Muffett from the Mexburn Swinton Astronomical Society. So first up today, don't forget it's the RSPB Big Garden Birdwatch 2026, and it's happening this weekend. It started yesterday. Over 590,000 people took part last year, counting 9.1 million birds. House sparrows took the top spot, but actually numbers of these birds are down by 60% compared to the first bird watch back in 1979. In fact, we've lost 38 million birds from the UK skies in the last 60 years. So with birds facing so many challenges, it's more important than ever to get involved in the bird watch. Every bird you do or indeed don't count will give the RSPB, that's the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds, a valuable insight into how garden birds are faring. It's really easy to take part. Choose a 1 hour period sometime today, which is Saturday the 24th of January, if you're listening on catch up, or tomorrow, Sunday the 25th of January, 26. Only record birds that land in your patch. And your patch can be a bit of your garden, balcony, local park or green space. Record the highest number of each bird species you see at any one time. Even if you see nothing at all, it still counts. And you could submit your results online or by post. Just Google RSPB Big Garden Birdwatch 2026. Also, another thing to get involved in, Sheffield Photographic Society Open Photography Competition 2026. It's got a 21st of February deadline. You can email spsphotography514@gmail.com for more information. They are very active on Facebook and Instagram as well, so you can find the details through there. Also, another reminder, it's a hot topic at the minute, www.smartphonefreechildhood.org. You can sign the Parent Pact online and join parents in your area who are delaying smartphones and social media. Next up is a story about First National River Walk created along the Mersey.
Yes, a new National River Walk will be created along the Mersey between Stockport and Manchester, the first of nine such paths promised by the government. The Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, DEFRA, said the 30-mile Mersey Valley Way would increase access to nature with new signs and improvements to the existing river path and boost local businesses by increasing visitors and supporting wider regeneration. The walk is the first of its kind and part of the government's manifesto pledge to create nine national river walks, one for each region of England, officials said. The Mersey Valley Way will have national river walk status, with plans for community engagement such as guided walks and volunteering opportunities where people can plant trees, remove invasive species, restore ponds and install bird, bat and insect boxes along the route. Stretches of the existing river path will also be upgraded for access by wheelchairs, mobility scooters, prams, cyclists and horse riders. The walk will be marked with new signage, with a competition to design the new logo launch for more than 50 local schools and youth groups along the Mersey, the winner of which will be announced in February. The government said the next tranche of National River Walks would be selected from competitive bids in a process going live in 2026. Baroness Hayman of Ullock, the Access Minister, said nature is a huge source of pride and enjoyment for people across the country, but too many people struggle to find ways to access the outdoors. We are changing that today, delivering on our manifesto pledge by launching the first of nine new National River Walks, boosting opportunities to be in the nature and supporting local businesses that line the routes.
All good stuff, eh? If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. We're every Saturday morning, 11 till 12, talking about science in all its different forms. In the science news this week, then, over the past four decades, the Arctic has warmed about four times faster than the global average, resulting in a dramatic reduction in sea ice. Modelling suggests the Arctic Ocean will be ice-free during the summer months by 2050. Hello, Paul.
Oh, yes. I was busy looking at something.
The beauty of live radio. Yes. I could have helped
in
there, of
course. I was busy getting ready for something else. Right. Artificial intelligence has overtaken sustainability as a topic on which British companies most want help from consultants, according to a survey by the Management Consultancies Association. I'm back.
He's back. Meanwhile, the UK government has indicated that it will consult on a possible social media ban for under-16s and toughen up rules on mobile phones in schools. Very interesting.
Interestingly, because we saw a couple of deer yesterday, didn't we?
We did, and I'm afraid I ate some on Saturday night as well. Thursday night.
Very nice. The deer population in Britain is now about 2 million, its highest in centuries, and a growing problem for sustainable management of forests and woodland. Regular shooting to control their numbers, with the meat sold as green alternative to beef, which has a far larger
environmental footprint, is one solution. Either that or reintroduce wolves as natural predators. It's an interesting one. Yeah, a lot of people are eating deer. And it is more sustainable than...
They don't call it venison now, do they?
Well, it seemed not to. Venison used to be mature deer, and then, of course, young deer, I think it's veal. Is it veal? I think so. Anyway, finally, before we speak to RPG, stroke patients who have lost the ability to talk have got their voices back thanks to a new device worn around the neck. Experts at the University of Cambridge have created ReVoice, a technology that uses sensors and artificial intelligence to decode speech signals and emotional cues. John Farnham with the voice there. I played that because experts at the University of Cambridge have created a bit of technology called Revoice to help stroke patients regain their ability to talk.
Wow.
Great stuff, eh? You listen to Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. We should have RPG on the line. Good morning, PG.
Good morning.
Good morning. Morning. So, what's caught your eye in the science news this week, then?
Oh, I was sort of looking around and I checked on Sheffield University, and that was one of the first things that sort of caught my eye. And it's some research that they've been doing, which they say that there's a language barrier that's really stalling the UK sustainability efforts. So, It's looking into language that's used, and the transition to the green economy, they say, is undermined by a language barrier, as folks on the street like me and everyone else.
I thought you were going to say me and thee, then, seeing as we're in Sheffield.
Yes, that's right there. Yeah. but struggle to understand technical terms like bio-based and compostable. That's what's appeared in the study. So they found the language used to describe sustainable materials is trapped in specialist and technical jargon, and it leaves a lot of people with no confidence in informing their choices about sustainability. So the nationwide survey of more than 2,000 UK consumers, also analysed by the research team, revealed a growing disconnect between trust and understanding. 51% of respondents stated they trusted compostability claims, yet only 22% understood what actually happens to waste once it's collected. And this report was produced by BBREG-NET, which is the UK's first regulatory science network for bio-based materials. And it's looking for practical solutions for businesses and policymakers. So the study found that terms like bioplastic and bio-based allowed greenwashing to thrive in a vacuum created by linguistic confusion. So basically, manufacturers and people are making claims about the sustainability of their products, but they're doing it in such a way as to confuse or to take advantage of people's confusion, because we don't actually know. So, I mean, I'm sick and tired of looking at sort of things like washing powder adverts that go, this is 10 times more effective than what? Yeah, so, this is going to be 4 times longer lasting than what? There's really, you know, lots of these sort of great jingoistic sort of terms that they churn out. And I mean, currently, I haven't spoken about it before, you know, this huge push for smells. You know, trying to persuade people that your home smells, you must buy this new product. You know, oh, your laundry smells, you must buy this super concentrated extra thing to put into your wash. And you sort of see that it's really sort of difficult for people. But they actually looked at the Oxford English Dictionary and the 52 billion word sort of tranche of contemporary English, where they found out that biodegradable appears just 1.5 times in a million words. Compostable is half a time in a million words.
Blimey.
Bio-based is 0.2 of a time, a fifth. And bioplastic is one-tenth of a word. So it, by comparison, it really sort of appears that other words appear a lot more in that sort of number. So the Professor Joanna Gavins, who's a professor of English language and literature at University of Sheffield, said people make sustainable choices, but they're being asked to navigate a language which they simply don't encounter often enough to understand. And so when terms are unfamiliar, inconsistent or poorly explained, people just disengage. So this survey was sort of carried, as I say, 2,000 consumers, 51% of whom said they trusted compostability claims, but only 22% understand what actually happens to waste when it's collected. And it's very much in the news, you know, with illegal dumping of waste in the UK at the moment, and some massive amounts of waste and subsequent pollution because it's dumped in places where it can be leached out into the waterways and rivers. So the key findings from it are negative disposal instructions as do not put in recycling are clearer and more effective than positive alternatives. Because quite often you'll see that packaging, things like plastic bottles, you say, yes, the body of the bottle is readily recyclable, but the cap isn't. So if you want to really get into it, you can start to try and break it down. But at the moment, I think we've got fairly broad-based bin collections here in Sheffield. There is a threat of a grey bin appearing, which, again, is sort of a lot of noise about them appearing, but very little actual sort of explanation of what they're going to do and what you can use them for. So, again, on a lot of products, instructions have got to be readable and actionable. I've spent a lot of time perusing sort of packaging to try and find out if it is recyclable. And it's not simple. It's not a big sort of thing. So it's a bit like the washing instructions that you get on some clothing. You've got to sort of get your glasses on and have a look.
And understand the symbols as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So, again, bioplastic, they say, should be avoided altogether because it's just spreading misunderstandings. And Professor Gavins added, recycling, it wasn't always second nature. It's become normal through clear, consistent communication and repetition. And sustainable materials need the same treatment. And the evidence shows how we need to, that we know how to fix it. So clear and simple, consistent labelling is essential. And if we want people to dispose of biodegradable materials correctly, without it, good intentions quickly turn into wrong behaviour. So it's not made easy for people. And, you know, there's been a massive campaign about contents in things like fast foods and stuff to filter out sort of people who've got sort of increasingly different allergies coming out, but nut allergies and things. And these people are having to study detailed sort of information on packaging rather than it being very in-your-face and apparent. And just as an example, one of the things that I was looking at recently was some Italian... pestos, and the bulk of the pestos now contain cashew nuts, and originally the recipe in Italy was for pine nuts, and it's really difficult to filter through the 20 or 30 other things that are in these sort of packs to find out if those nuts are there. So again, what you do with the packaging, quite often it's sort of something like a yogurt tub, and they say the foil is not sort of reusable, but the body of the thing could be reusable. A lot of things for the process of these materials, like if you put bottles into your glass waste, do you try and remove the metal caps? Those sorts of things. So I think it is a good point, and I think it's one of those things that would be useful if we are going to try and tidy up the processing of waste, that they actually do put some weight behind advertising it and making it more sort of a straightforward idea, rather than it being this sort of bit of a secretive thing hidden away in the corner of lots of other information on packaging, that you've really got to study to find out whether they are reusable or not.
Yeah, interesting. I did see only the other day an article about toothpaste tubes.
Yep.
Difficult. Apparently, manufacturers have been working on this from March 2022, but I think there's new laws coming in. They've all got to be recyclable because there used to be like a layer of foil or something in there. You know, I don't know. I can't remember what the tubes were, but yeah. And well, also, go on, Paul.
Yeah, I mean, some of them are sort of an aluminium sort of product, but increasingly these days they're plastic tubes.
Yeah.
And again, it's what's in the plastic, and we've talked about the sort of particle sizes that occur when they start to break down. But this is right at the outset that you really could do with that information being readily available to you, and much more widely known.
Yeah. The other thing about the bins, Paul, what I read the other day as well, that the laws about bins and recycling, the government's now got a policy that it's the same, it's going to be the same across the entire country. I think we've got to have four bins now, haven't we? And the new one is that grey bin, which I think is food waste.
Yeah. And I say, it's one of those things that... even though, we tend to be looking through the news for things that are happening, whereas a lot of people, it's a much more casual approach to that, and how much of that is getting across to people who probably don't read the newspaper these days.
Yet, to be fair, I've not seen anything obvious from Sheffield City Council about the changes, and yet I think they're imminent.
Yeah, that's absolutely, and I think it is a good point that even something at that sort of higher end of the scale of information is poorly done, and I think that when you get down to a lot of small packages, it really isn't. I don't know if we can get a coloured scheme in terms of a spot if it's something that goes in one bin or another. They really could do with a new sort of light system or something that makes it very, very simple.
Oh, I said, Paul, you ought to have a job in government. Paul for mayor of South Yorkshire.
No.
Hey, but it's right, isn't it? Because it is confusing. And I'll also say, I know this is about recycling and having four bins. Sounds all very wonderful, but if you live in a terraced house...
Yeah,
or something. It's almost blight, isn't it?
Well, Charleville Road.
Yeah. I know. So it can be intrusive and aesthetically in your landscape, in your where you live. Do you really want to see a whole raft of bins?
Yeah. Well, I know. Where we are on the station. If you go down in the basement, we've got several different bins for different types of waste. So paper waste. Plastic waste and sort of peculiar waste, I guess, but then quite often
furniture,
a skip for other things,
for broken things.
it does cause confusion, and if you're in that sort of situation and you take a bundle of rubbish down, you've got to try and work out what should go in whichever bin. So I think it's a good point well made from University of Sheffield. And I guess from on the back of that, the thing that caught my eye as well was we've just had some information on the Earthshot Prize, which is William and part of the royal family, the idea of promoting good projects that help to save the planet. And William's been down to Bristol here in the UK to see a company called Matter, M-A-T-T-E-R, and they are one of the entries into the Earthshot Prize. And that's, I think, the winners. I think there are five winners who get £1 million apiece to develop their projects or ideas. And what Matter have done is to come up with a self-cleaning filter for homes and factories to stop harmful microplastics from entering our rivers, oceans and water supplies. So this is a fitting that goes onto your washing machine, which is one of the big ways that we pour pollution out, because it goes straight out in the water that's used for rinses into the sewage system and out to our rivers and out to the oceans eventually. So it's becoming one of the planet's biggest environmental threats. Today they say there are more than 171 trillion particles that float in our oceans, and that's disrupting the ocean's blue carbon pump, the system that generates over half of the world's oxygen and captures about 40% of global carbon. So it's a very laudable idea, is that you can put on a filter to take those plastics out of the system before they sort of exit into our waterways. And it says that particles are now turning up in our food, in our own organs, even in unborn children. And they say that there's really a need for urgent action to clear this. And Matter's come up with this great idea to apply. And apparently Williams had these filters fitted to the laundry facilities in his home because of this. So it's a great idea from a city. I mean, Bristol's very forward in the green innovation area. So this is not like a traditional filter. It's self-cleaning. They say it's cost efficient and hugely scalable, so you can make a big version for industrial things through to how it impacts on global supply chains. And in the textile industry, it's already making a difference. It's the first filter built specifically to target microplastic fibres and prevent them from entering the waterways. So in ambitions to deliver enough solutions across the textiles and laundry industries to capture 15,000 tonnes of microfiber. it's very good. Said it captures up to 97% of fibres without the need for replacement cartridges. So they're also going to collaborate with some of the big washing machine manufacturers and hoping to launch this across Europe as well. So I think a very laudable bit of development there.
Yeah, and a practical solution to a problem that is just widespread, isn't it? Everybody washes the clothes, or you hope they do.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think on the back of that, I was looking to see, we've got a lot of stuff about the water companies releasing microplastics out into the rivers and again back into the oceans. And to counter that, I think they've just had a study done which says they filter out 99.9% from drinking water before they send it out. So That sounds okay, but the problem is in the processing of water, they use little plastic pellets, and they use them to attract the microorganisms that are in water to take them out. And through that process, not by intent, but sometimes they get split and damaged and can flow through the outlets. They can be released. Just trying to nail down if there's a standard set for the quality of our water. There is, but it's a bit outdated. So, again, who would understand? Because there is a mark for water filtering systems, which on one side of the coin, the argument is that they're not necessary. And on the other side of that coin is people saying, well, we believe they are because, look, you know, we've got our bodies starting to build up very recognisable, significant quantities of microplastics. So I think it's really one of those key things, you know, is how you live your life. One thing is you can contribute with the first main about Sheffield Uni's study, but the other point is how you get information and understand what you're facing. And I think that with the water supply is such a fundamental sort of need that it really does need a massive overhaul.
As I said, Paul, you should be mayor. Yep. Mayor. Take that challenge up. So
yes, unfortunately, a lot of people would think it was a nightmare.
Oh, but you've chosen a fantastic track to go with your story, and it is a track that I know our Chris loves as well because he sent it in.
Yeah, and the key thing about it is that the lyrics are a load of rubbish.
Well, but it's a good song, isn't it? C'est plan pour moi. And on that note, thank you, Paul. And we shall speak to you Monday, Glory Days Rock Show, 1 till 3.
I look forward
bye
to
bye
it.
Bye-bye, Paul. Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye.
Sur mon lit à bouffer sa langue en buvant trop mon whisky. Quant à moi, peu dormi, vie débris. Mais j'ai dû dormir dans la gouttière où j'ai eu un flash. Ouh-ouh-ouh. En quatre couleurs. Allez hop, un matin, une louloute est venue chez moi. Poupée de cellophane, cheveux chinois. Un sparadrap, une gueule de bois. A bu ma bière dans un grand verre en caoutchouc. Comme un indien dans son igloo. Ça plane pour moi. Ça plane pour moi. Ça plane pour moi. Moi, 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 moi. Ça plane pour moi. Ouh-ouh-ouh. Ça plane pour moi. Allez hop, la nana, quel panard, quelle vibration de s'envoyer sur paillasson. Limé, ruiné, vidé, comblé. You are the king of the divan. Qu'elle me dit en passant. Ooh, I am the king of the divan. Ça plane pour moi. Ça plane pour moi. Ça plane pour moi. Moi, 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 moi. Ça plane pour moi. Ooh, ça plane pour moi. Allez hop, t'occupe, t'inquiète, touche pas ma planète. Today, que le ciel me tombera sur la tête et que la colle me manquera. C'est marre à tout casser, les vieilles.
Great track there, Saplan Pour Moi by Plastic Bertrand, because RPG was talking about microplastics, all good stuff. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to the Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. We should have our Chris on the line.
Come fly with me, let's fly away. If you can use some exotic booze, there's a bar in far Bombay. Come on and fly with me. Let's fly.
Good morning, Chris.
Morning, eh? What a cracking track that was. What a cracking piece by PG. Really well done.
I know. I said PG for mayor. PG for...
No.
But yeah, it's all good stuff, Chris. And a great bit of music to bring you in with as well. Come Fly With Me by Frank Sinatra. So what could you be talking about, I wonder?
We are talking about why plane turbulence is becoming more frequent and more severe.
Excellent. We did try that last year, and unfortunately, our phone signal wasn't that great.
We had some turbulence.
We had some turbulence on the line.
Yeah. Okay, so what is turbulence? So severe turbulence is defined as when the up and down movements of a plane going through disturbed air exert more than 1.5 G-force on your body, and that's enough to lift you out of your seat if you weren't wearing a seatbelt. Estimates show that there are around 5,000 incidents of severe or greater turbulence every year out of a total of more than 35 million flights that now take off globally. And that's about 0.01%. But obviously, some routes don't suffer with turbulence and some routes have a lot more turbulence. And I'm going to talk about that in a little while. So of the severe injuries caused to passengers flying throughout 2024, almost 40% were caused by turbulence, according to the annual safety report by the International Civil Aviation Organization. So that's still quite significant numbers, isn't it?
It is, 40%.
So I've got an example here of a recent story that was in a newspaper. So Andrew Davis was on his way to New Zealand to work on a Doctor Who exhibition for which he was the project manager. The first leg of his flight from London to Singapore was fairly smooth. But when they left Singapore to fly to New Zealand, the plane suddenly hit severe turbulence. Being on a roller coaster is the only way I can describe it, he recalls. After being pushed into my seat really hard, we suddenly dropped. My iPad hit me in the head. Coffee went all over me. There was devastation in the cabin with people and debris everywhere. People were crying. There was just disbelief about what had happened. But Mr. Davis said he was one of the lucky ones. Other passengers were left with gashes and broken bones, and sadly, a gentleman who was 73 years old died of a heart attack.
Blimey.
Isn't that... I know. I don't know whether you've ever been on a plane with severe turbulence. I haven't.
No.
We've had
some turbulence, but not anything like that.
No, me neither. But I've got a little story for you at the end of this, which regarding my brother, who's just experienced something like that. So death as a consequence of turbulence is extremely rare. There are no official figures, but they are estimated to have roughly been around 4 deaths since 1981. Injuries, however, tell a much different story. In the United States alone, there have been 207 severe injuries where an individual has been admitted to hospital for more than 48 hours, and that's since 2009. Of these, 166 were crew, and that's probably because they weren't seated, so they could have been standing or walking or pushing a trolley around, something like that. But as climate change shifts atmospheric conditions, experts warn that air travel could become bumpier. Temperature changing and shifting wind patterns in the upper atmosphere are expected to increase the frequency and intensity of severe turbulence. We can now expect a doubling or tripling in the amount of severe turbulence around the world in the next few decades, said Professor Paul Williams, an atmospheric scientist at the University of Reading. And this stat is quite interesting. So for every 10 minutes of turbulence experienced now, this could increase to 20 or 30 minutes in the future.
Oh, doesn't sound good.
Doesn't sound good. But as I said to you, it is a small amount that it ever happens to, but when it does happen, it could be catastrophic, as that example explained. So they have, we talked about some of the routes, and one of the routes is known as the Bumpy North Atlantic Route, and this is the route between the UK, the United States, Canada and the Caribbean, is now amongst the areas known to have been affected. Over the last 40 years since satellites began observing the atmosphere, there has been a 55% increase in severe turbulence over the North Atlantic. So, and this is a knock-on effect of climate change. So climate change just affects everything, even your holiday travel.
Exactly.
There are three main causes of turbulence. There's convective, which is caused by clouds or thunderstorms. There's orographic, which is the airflow around mountainous areas. And then there's something called clear air, which is changes in wind direction or speed. And each of those three can bring severe turbulence to aeroplanes. Avoiding turbulence-producing storms, so planes now, if they know that there's going to be severe turbulence, they now look to try and go round it. And that can cause crowded airspaces as more planes are forced to change routes, according to experts. And this is another amazing stat. In 2014, US study found that for every 1 degree rise in global temperature, lightning strikes increase by 12%.
Not what you want when you're on your plane.
No. Planes are quite protected, I think, from lightning strikes. They're okay with that. But anyway, an expert says this should be a worry to us all. So the increase in severe turbulence, enough to lift you out of your seat, could potentially bring more instances of injury or possible death in the most severe cases. More than a fifth of UK adults say they are scared of flying, according to a recent YouGov survey, and worsening turbulence could make journeys even more of a nightmare for these people. More turbulence to some passengers equals more chance of something going wrong and less chance of survival. However, aircraft wings are designed to fly through turbulent air. The wings are very strong and flexible. So, for example, even a 747 passenger aircraft under destructive testing, the wings are bent upwards by some 25 degrees before they snap, which is really extreme and something that would never happen even in the most severe turbulence. But as I said, the cost of this there is a cost to the turbulence to the airlines. So costs can range from about $180,000 to $1.5 million per airline annually. And this includes the costs of having to check and maintain aircraft after severe turbulence, compensation costs if a flight has had to be diverted or delayed, or costs associated with landing in the wrong location. So climate change is one factor in making turbulence worse, because it increases both storm-related and clear air turbulence. And diverting around turbulence-producing storms can have a wider impact. For example, if a lot of aircraft are having to change flight paths, airspace can get more crowded. And having to fly around storms also means extra fuel and extra time, which, of course, is, again, significant. And the person that will end up paying for that, of course, is the customer.
Yeah.
So in 2019, it was said that bad weather forced airlines to fly 1 million extra kilometres, producing an extra 19,000 tonnes of CO2. And this also increases the workload for pilots and air traffic controllers. So with extreme weather predicted to increase, they expect flights will need to divert around bad weather, such as storms and turbulence, even more by 2050. And this will drive up the costs to the airline, cost to the passengers, and increase their carbon footprint. Wow. So what are airlines doing to compensate this? Well, first of all, forecasting turbulence has got better in recent years. And whilst it's not perfect, airlines can now correctly forecast around 75% of clear air turbulence. And 20 years ago, it was more like 50 to 60%. So thanks to better research and better equipment, that has got better. Aircraft also, or airlines have also invested in better weather radar that picks up storms ahead. So before a flight, most airlines will produce a flight plan that details area of likely turbulence throughout the route based on advanced computer modelling. So it's not 100% accurate, but it just gives the plane much better information. Now, even if turbulence does become more frequent and more severe, experts argue it's not a case to worry about. It's nothing more than annoying. It makes flights more uncomfortable, and it might also mean that some passengers may experience more air sickness. And me, having sat next to somebody that suffered with air sickness once, it wasn't a very pleasant flight,
no, it
I can
isn't.
Assure you. It also means that passengers would have to spend more time sitting down with seatbelts fastened. And I've also understand that some airlines have even stopped serving hot food and drinks on certain routes to protect passengers from being burnt. So they don't serve hot coffee, hot tea, that sort of stuff, if they know that they're flying, say, over a mountainous area where turbulence is likely. So
yeah,
they've stopped doing that.
Wow. Amazing.
So I was just going to give a shout out to my brother Stephen, who has just flown to Buenos Aires.
Oh, I say.
In Argentina. Do you know what Buenos Aires stands for?
Oh, go on.
Fair winds. So it's very appropriate for this conversation. Anyway, he sent me a message and said it was 10 hours of turbulence and the flight was very uncomfortable. Ooh. So my poor brother and his wife Anne had to sit on the plane for nearly 10 hours as it bounced up and down, and he said it was awful. So he needed a couple of beers when he got off the plane.
But 10 hours, the thing is, Chris, once you're up there in the air, you can't really say, oh, hang on, I want to get off.
Yeah, no, exactly. I completely agree. And that's sort of one of the reasons why my wife and I don't fly that much. We've never liked flying. It's not so much that we're scared about crashing or anything like that. It's just more because it's uncomfortable. And if something does go wrong, you're stuck, aren't you? You just can't move.
But this is it. But it's interesting about the climate change issue, because you're saying that the planes can avoid it going round the storm, but that's creating extra mileage and therefore extra carbon dioxide, which is sort of like a vicious circle then, because it's climate change induced, isn't it?
Yep.
So,
and also, you can't always avoid it, because if you're coming in to land at an airport and you're, say, flying over a mountain range to sort of come down to land, sometimes you just have to go through it and it's unavoidable.
It's that feeling of dropping, isn't it, I think, as well. That feeling of lack of control. And then, of course, you're in a confined space and everybody reacts differently. Yeah.
But can you imagine those poor passengers on that flight to New Zealand that had that severe turbulence and people broke bones and that sort of thing? It must have been absolutely terrifying.
It reminds me of Castaway with Tom Hanks. That's enough to put you off flying forever. The depiction of that crash in the storm. There you go.
I mean, let's just hope that the flight back is a lot better for my brother.
Mm. Blimey, Charlie. Brilliant stuff, Chris. You were sounding loud and clear. So
thanks for
joining us. We're going to play you out with a bit more of Come Fly With Me. Bye-bye, Chris.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Come fly with me, let's fly away. If you can use some exotic booze, there's a bar in far Bombay. Come on and fly with me, let's fly away. Come fly with me, let's float down to Peru. In Llama Land, there's a one-man band, and he'll toot his flute for you. Come on, fly with me, let's take off in the blue. Once I get you up there, where the air is rarefied, we'll just glide starry-eyed. Once I get you up there, I'll be holding you so near, you may hear all the angels cheer, because we're together weather-wise. It's such a lovely day, just say the words and we'll beat the birds down to Acapulco Bay. It is perfect for a flying honeymoon. They say, come fly with me, let's fly away. Once I get you up there, where the air is rarefied, we'll just glide starry-eyed. Once I get you up there, I'll be holding you so very near, you might even hear a whole gang of cheers, just because we're together weather-wise. It's such a cuckoo day. You just say those words and we'll...
Beautiful song. You forget how good that is, actually. Come Fly With Me by Frank Sinatra from 1958. Thank you to Chris for doing an excellent talk about why plane turbulence is getting worse.
Puts us off flying forever.
Well, yeah, all linked to climate change. You're listening to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. We are coming to the end of this week's edition. Just time to talk about ministers to give advice on toddlers' screen time. If you tuned in at the beginning of the show, you were just talking about the UK government has indicated it will consult on a possible social media ban for under-16s and toughen up rules on mobile phones in schools. All controversial and a hot topic at the minute. This article said, parents of under-5s will be offered advice on managing screen use after government research suggested toddlers who spend the most time on devices speak significantly fewer words than their peers. Now, Bridget Phillipson, the Education Secretary, will publish the first official guidance on screen time for under-5s in April. Alongside it, lessons will be offered to parents attending Best Start Family Hubs, which are the successors to Sure Start centres, which provide support for young families, including early education and health advice. This will include advice on how best to support development, including speech and language, and on the perils of screen time for vocabulary. Wes Streeting, the Health Secretary, has told his department to produce advice on Australia's ban on social media for children, including the evidence for it. Their law in Australia, a world first, was introduced on December the 10th, barring under-16s from X, Facebook, Instagram, Reddit, TikTok, YouTube, Snapchat, Twitch, Kick and Threads. The government research on under-2s showed higher screen use was linked to poor language development. Children with the highest levels of screen time, which is about 5 hours a day, could say significantly fewer words than those with the lowest screen time per day at about 45 minutes a day. By the age of 2, children watch an average of 127 minutes a day, up from 29 minutes at 9 months. The survey was of main caregivers, mostly mothers, of almost 5,000 children when they were 9 months old, and that was back in 2022. And then again at 2 years old, which was October 23 to February 24. They included television screens as well as mobile devices. Bridget Phillipson, the Education Secretary, said, like many parents, I've had evenings where you just give in, when your little wants just one more episode of their favourite show, but we're beginning to see the risks when just one more starts to add up. As adults, how many of us walk around with faces in our phones or sit on the train fixated on our tablet? We use them for hours every day and maybe wish we didn't, but what about our children? So that's all about ministers will give advice on toddler screen time coming this April. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.